weeping now and clenching my teeth, at my wit's end, trying to have it all make sense. What do I do with them? And in the same calm voice, God said, I've given you gifts. Share them. I've given you light. Brighten the world. I empower you with my love. Love them. That did it. After all I'd been through, I'd had it with sweet words. Who was he trying to kid? I pounded my fist in exasperation and said, love them. What are you trying to do to me? Can't you see? They call my light darkness. They call my love perverted. They call my gifts corruptions. What the hell are you asking me to do? My words echoed in the silence. My breath stopped. It felt vaguely like 11 years before when I'd lain on a football field at Milton Academy and cursed the God who sat before me. Only now it was different. Now he was here. Now I believed. God, I was scared. There was much silence. God didn't move a muscle, though his gaze was much more intense. And with a voice filled with compassion, a voice that enveloped me with its love, God spoke. Love them anyway, he said. Love them anyway. In the second chapter, John points out that although his story is uniquely his, just as each one of our stories are uniquely ours, there are many common threads in the spiritual journey of gay people. Almost every one of us starts out by denying that we are gay, denying that we are Christian, assuming that our spirituality and our sexuality don't jive, and one of them has got to go. We try and live with that dichotomy. We get into guilt, hiding, banishing ourselves in closets. We find ourselves alienated from ourselves, from each other, from our society, from our church, and from our God. Accepting both our sexuality and our spirituality often puts us in an outcast place. We are often seen by the gay subculture as having gone crazy. How can you be part of an institution that has had so much to do over the years with condemning us, burning us at the stake, physically mutilating us, ostracizing us, excommunicating us, all of these wonderful little things? And in the church, often we are, as I read in one article, coming out in the church often means coming out of the church. And in the most ideal situations, we sometimes find acceptance and love. Most often, we find ourselves either kept in our closets by the choice of others, ignoring or not wanting to deal with who we are and what we represent. Often, we find ourselves just simply being tolerated. We are here, we are being open and honest about who we are, and that's, well, I guess that's okay, but, you know, if that's the way it's got to be, that's the way it's got to be. What that means for us as gay people is that we are, at the same time, in a very uncomfortable, rejected kind of place, but it also gives us an incredible opportunity for spiritual development. God's charge is to all of us too. Love them anyway. Loving anyway, sharing anyway, giving gifts even when no one wants them, embracing the exile. It demands a profound belief that not only can life on the fringes be endured by gay Christians, but that being banished can be viewed as an incredible spiritual opportunity. To give and love while all the while being disdained as the most abject of people gives us such distinctive lampstands on which to perch our lamps that when our brothers and sisters see the light we emit and the good we do, they may even more profoundly give praise to God in heaven. Gay Christians' freedom to love and give in a hostile world hinges upon their coming to believe in their wholeness and in their having a rightful place in God's universe. That is something that each of us, I think, struggles with, both gay people and non-gay people. As he will point out later, that's made more difficult for gay people in that we don't have hardly any of the support things and we don't have other people telling us often that we have a rightful place in God's way and that we have a rightful scheme of things in the coming kingdom. From there, we dive into some theory about the psycho-spiritual journey. Talks about the origin of the dualism of mind and spirit, when that arises, thinking that our spirit is one thing and our mind is another, how that's a very recent development. He talks about how things might have been different if Freud had not been a medical doctor, and how the whole field of psycho-spiritual journeying might have been different if it had been more directly connected to its past in witch doctors, medicine men, shamans, people of, you know, who are clergy, people who are traditionally associated with spiritual and mental well-being. He talks about different ways toward wholeness, paths for the journey we're talking about. Psychology, he understands as surrendering, understanding oneself, relating everything in terms of the self. Spirituality, he sees as getting beyond oneself. And he talks about this in terms of a model of a DNA module, a double helix, that there's a spiritual strand and a psychological strand, and that they both go the same direction. The spiritual strand he sees as the dominant one, and the leaps that occur back and forth are always from the psychological to the spiritual. Molly pointed out to me that this is straight from Teilhard de Chardin, even though John Fortunato apparently is not aware of this.
It's always from the psychological to the
spiritual. Always from the psychological to the spiritual, understanding the self and then transcending the self. We go from there to talking about ourselves and our system. He calls this chapter The Enthronement of the Ego and the Myth. And he says, the basic dilemma of an egocentric world is this. With the ego planted firmly at the center of the universe, what do we do with all of the multitudinous data of human experience that constantly remind us of our powerlessness? The answer is that you block it all out, which brings us to what I call the myth. Put succinctly, the myth is the tenacious belief that we really are in control of ourselves, our destinies, each other, and the world. It gives enormous power to the ego. As I was reading it, I couldn't help but see the similarities with what Ann Wilson Schaeff talks about in Women's Reality, that our dominant system is a way where we believe that we can control things, and that we, you know, the self is a powerful entity, and that by buttressing ourselves from all the things that don't jive with our system, we can ignore them and keep on going, and everything will be just fine. It says, well, for the myth to work, everybody has to believe in it. Children are indoctrinated into it from infancy on. Belief in its reality is reinforced by schools, colleges, and all of our other social institutions. It governs every aspect of our lives. Adherence to the myth is a must, and sanctions are applied against recalcitrants. Can you imagine the vice president of a multinational corporation suggesting to the president that the latest planned merger is really unnecessary, besides they're powerful enough already, and besides it's all really a game? Insofar as patients, he's talking about psychological patients, insofar as patients buy into this mythical view of society as normal and themselves as eccentric, their goal will be to renovate themselves. The goal is to be in control. The self is it. The self is the core of the system. If you can control things, you'll be okay. One reason a lot of people get into psychotherapy and get onto a spiritual journey is because the myth doesn't work for them, for whatever reason. And many people come into therapy with the assumption that the myth isn't working for them, therefore something is wrong with them. As he'll say later, when we talk more about this journey, oftentimes it's not a matter of reintegrating the self into the system. Oftentimes it's a matter of strengthening the self to exist in a valid way despite the system. Which takes us to chapter 4, what he calls the gay predicament, what I have called How Gay People Get Started on a psycho-spiritual journey. We'll talk more about this in chapter 8, but he talks about how gay people are, from the beginning, excluded from the myth. Talks about why gay people tend, when they get into a therapy situation, to be more spiritually oriented than people who are not gay, why they ask more spiritual questions. The kinds of frustrations that land both gay and straight people in therapy then are very much the same: family difficulties, job insecurity, marriage problems, loneliness. The intensity of those frustrations is often much greater for gay people, but in a way that's irrelevant. What is relevant is that gay people most often are unable to resolve the frustrations in the ways that straight people do. Using the concept of the myth described in the last chapter, we can put it this way. Both gay and straight people end up in therapy because some part of the myth isn't working. They have spun off from their galaxy of systems. That experience creates anxiety, and they want relief from it. For the gay person as well as the straight, the hope is for reintegration, but here the similarity ceases. Gays are blocked from reintegration within the mythic system. They are stuck with their frustrations. That's the gay predicament. He talks about how the further gay people get into this, the more they tend to realize that the only way to get out of this anxiety-ridden situation is to go deeper. I remember a phrase that I heard often when I was in primal therapy: the only way out is through. If it hurts, make it hurt more, and then you'll be able to deal with it. Experience the pain and the frustration as fully as you possibly can, and at that point, you'll be forced to a place where it all has a different perspective. The fact is that American society is bulwarked to prevent gay people from getting in. Most of the mythical systems and structures, conventions and customs, which heterosexual people use to allay their angst and their sense of human powerlessness, are off limits to homosexual people. He talks about what happens to people who are faced with that kind of predicament. Ultimately, they get depressed. They may run from it for a while. They may get angry for a while, grow bitter at the injustice of their life situation, but sooner or later, they get depressed. Very, very depressed, often suicidal. It is when they reach that rock-bottom place where there is nothing to do but drink the oppression to the dregs that gay people are thrust to their spiritual roots with a force only oppressed people can understand. Faced with the full impact of human angst and no way to escape, they shout angrily and terrified into the abyss, "Why me?" It is no surprise, then, that either right from the beginning or as the therapy progresses, gay people ask an inordinate number of spiritual questions. Either because they realize it when they come to therapy or discover it in the process, they come to grips with the frightening reality that they must give up the myth forever. Since their progress up the ego strand of the helix is blocked, the only choice they have is to jump to the other strand. Whether or not they consciously grasp their yearning as a need for spiritual grounding, the cry into the abyss is an acknowledgement that the only way out is deeper. In order for gay people to get to a place where they can love in a world that rejects both their loving and giving, they first have to embrace a consciousness that transcends the society that rejects them as misfits, a cosmic wisdom that comprehends the oneness of the universe in which the gay person inextricably belongs. The psyche-spirit split must be debunked and the myth abandoned. Once you know at the core of your being that you have a rightful place in God's creation, that nothing can separate you from the love of God, then it doesn't much matter what people say or do to you. Then you are free to give and love anyway. The next three chapters talk about a psychological spiritual journey. He has a couple of basic tenets that he brings to every one of his patients, and that he brings or has as cornerstones of his ways of looking at this. First of all, that each one of us on the journey contains enormous amounts of pain from any number of life experiences. Second, to progress on a psychological journey, we need to grieve We need to grieve our pain, acknowledge our hurts, and let them hurt until we can learn to move on despite them. Third, to progress on a spiritual journey, we need to grieve our absolute out-of-controlness. We need to grieve our very state of being. As he says on page 73, everything we have used to even reinforce ourselves has to go. The paradox is that exercising the ego, in fact pushing it to its limits, is seen as absolutely essential for spiritual growth, but only so you can get to figure out how dumb it is. He says that it's really important to try and push the system to the limits, to make it accommodate you, to be as angry as possible, to try and work things out as much as possible, and at a point where you can't push any further, it clicks and you go, that was really stupid. This isn't going to work. At this point, he introduces a little vignette that I think is really appropriate. I wanted an example for the end of this chapter, a clear and striking illustration of someone's spiritual journey to total union with God. As it happens, I'm writing on Palm Sunday, the beginning of Holy Week. What more striking example of the spiritual journey to total union with God than that of Jesus of Nazareth? Jesus knew what it meant to be attached to things: his mother, zeal for his father's house, contempt for the priests and Pharisees. Perhaps more than anything else, he was attached to his ardent desire that people truly hear the good news he came to share. He takes from there and talks about how these attachments are let go of, that we can see in the Gospels. It's hard to believe that Jesus was at peace as he hung there. How could you be at peace with thorns sticking into your head, your back slashed to ribbons, and spikes driven through your wrists and feet? But I believe he was, totally in the moment, not wanting it to be different from how it was, not yearning for it to be over, just doing what had to be done. And we call him the Christ. Why? Not because he is the only person to have died for his faith. Lots of people have done that. And not because he achieved union with God either. Others have done that too. We call him Christ because no one before or since has both loved so totally and given up so much. He came bearing all love and allowed himself to be consumed by all evil. The odds he faced on the journey to enlightenment were overwhelming. Only God could have done it. In the end, how was it for him? There was no demanding or coercing, no regrets, no expectations, no analyzing. He was just being. Just simply being. Just simply being crucified. In the eighth chapter, he talks about some of the grieving that gay people have to do. I've called this a few words about being gay. We've looked at the journey, we've looked at the myth, we've looked at grieving. Now we must look at how all of this relates to the gay predicament. In the course of a lifetime, some people have to grieve more than others. There's no reason for it. It's not necessarily fair. People ask, why me? God answers, why not? There is little use in calling it cruel and inhuman. It just is. There's a danger in even saying some people have to grieve more than others. It can trigger obnoxious outpourings of indulgent self-pity. After all, what do you get from knowing that you have a harder row to hoe than the next person? When all is said and done, your row is your row. It talks about how it's important to understand the things that make the gay predicament what it is. People tend to underestimate the plight of gay people. Gays often soft sell their lot, mostly because they've gotten used to it. It feels normal. Bleeding heart heterosexuals understate gay oppression mostly to assuage their consciences. Oh, it's not really so much worse for gays. Things are rough all around. And of course, conservative reactionaries, moral majority types, think that anything short of burning at the stake is too lenient. Talks about some of the things that gay people have to deal with, some of the things that gay people have to grieve as a social unit. And I'll just run down some of them and interject a few things. Families. Often coming out to our families means total or partial rejection from our parents, from our children, from our spouses, from our siblings. If not immediate total rejection, which often happens, a sense of partial rejection. the issue is not ever talked about. It's like, that part of me doesn't exist. Or it's a gay person's sexuality is used often as a means of harassment. He talks about one of his patients whose mother would call him like twice a week and say, well, who's my queer son screwing around with this week? That kind of thing happens to gay people. Or we are told, yes, you are gay, I accept that, that's fine. Don't ever bring a lover home. Whether that's said or not, often that's a very strong message. I can handle your being gay as long as you're the only one. He talks about grieving friends. Coming out to close friends. Most gay people hope very much that they will keep their straight friends. Often they do, often they do not. Gay people tend to hit a raw nerve in heterosexual people with whom they are intimately associated. There's a lot of, in our whole culture, there's a lot of stuff wrapped up in sexuality. And the fact that it's gay sexuality makes it even worse. To have kind of a gnawing feeling that there's some sort of sexual tension in a relationship is bad enough. If it's with a male friend, if you're a gay man, or with a female friend, if you're a lesbian woman, that tension can be enough to drive the relationship apart. Job security. Openly gay people can and routinely are fired just because if they are in teaching professions, the clergy, government work, or positions where they require security clearances, or just from any job. Coming out at the job can and often does mean being fired or being harassed to the point where resignation is the only productive way out. Rights, health, legal or police protection. For example, just last year in the city of Seattle, it was made an offense for verbally harassing or beating up on, causing physical violence upon a gay or lesbian person. Just last year. Often, if gay people are even physically harmed, go to the police, it's really unreasonable to expect any sort of follow-up on your case or even any protection. If I, for instance, was to call the Seattle Police Department and say, I've been followed home from work by this group of people who are harassing me and threatening to beat me up, you know, every day for the last 2 weeks, I need some help. 9 times out of 10, that's an unreasonable request. In most states, sexual acts between two people of the same sex is still a felony and can reap up to 10 years in prison. As I mentioned earlier, in the churches, coming out usually means tolerance at the best, burning or mutilation at the worst. Interpersonal things that gay people have to grieve as a result of coming out. Beneficiary rights. If you're involved in a committed covenant relationship with someone, it's very difficult to name that person as a beneficiary in your will, to take out joint insurance policies, to name your spouse or lover a beneficiary on your life insurance policy. You're denied public affirmations of your joining, as in a heterosexual marriage. You are also denied public affirmation of your separating, which can also make things very ugly for gay people. There is no divorce. Gay people can be just as bitter and angry at a divorce as straight people can. And the fact that there is no legal format for that and no way for the society at large to recognize that this relationship is dissolving can be a very painful thing. You're denied public affection. Holding hands, going for a walk in the park, arm in arm, kissing goodbye on a street corner. Little things. No way. Social situations. What do you do? You're invited to a company dinner and the invitation says, bring a friend. If you, as he says in the book, if you and your lover go, or you and your boyfriend or woman friend, things will be really uncomfortable for both of you and for everyone at the gathering. If you don't take them and you arrange a mock date with someone else, or if you go alone, you both have a miserable time doing your respective things. Holidays. What do you do at Christmas, at Thanksgiving, family times? Unless your family is very enlightened and accepting and loving and cherishing of your relationship, chances are your relationship won't be welcome. Large family gatherings, how do you explain your, how do you deal with that in a large extended family situation? Again, if you and your spouse go to your respective families, you miss the most important days of the year with each other. You both feel miserable for not being together. If you spend them together, you lose out with your family relationships. Another big one, probably the biggest one, is the closet. Denying to yourself, saying, okay, I'm gay, that's it, I'm not going to deal with it, it doesn't exist. And trying to structure your life and live your life denying that large part of yourself. That can run you into trouble in all kinds of ways. The whole feeling of, what if somebody finds out? Or what if somebody guesses? Or what if people are talking about me? It's a terrifying feeling. I've been there, I know. The tension you store as a result of trying to cover your tracks all the time can lead to migraines, bleeding ulcers, all kinds of physical disorders because of the enormous amount of pressure you're putting yourself into. The point is that we are not looking at some negative philosophical hypothesis on society's part that a gay person may simply disagree with and choose to ignore. We are looking at a monolithic system bent on making life for gay people as miserable as possible. It confronts the gay person at every turn. In the words of a close friend, you live with being gay every minute of your life. What may be hardest about helping gay people give up all of this stuff is their lack of choice about their plight. The giving up gay people don't have to do, or the giving up that gay people have to do, doesn't begin voluntarily. Most would just as soon buy into the myth and live as happily ever after as they think their straight counterparts are living. The bottom line, of course, is that gay people don't just have a choice. Oppression is simply what gay people face when they are authentic with themselves and with their world. It is not enough in therapy to help gay people transform a negative self-image into a positive one, because the world into which they emerge is quite literally out to get them. It's not a paranoid projection, it's for real. Not only must gay people give up attachment to what might have been, but wasn't, they must also let go of what might be now and isn't, and what the future might have held, but won't. It's important to keep this in mind when working with gay people. It is worse than useless to harbor the illusion, let alone communicate it to your patient, that having completed therapy, the gay patient will find a way to live happily ever after. This is foolish even if you're working with straight patients, and it is frankly cruel to offer that kind of hope to a gay patient. They will ask for it. They will want to believe that if they just work hard in therapy, make the right changes in their lives, that the burden of oppression meted out to them as gay people will be lifted off their shoulders. That kind of hope you cannot offer. Your silence in the face of such verbalized hopes, painful though it may be, will, however, help the patient deeper into the abyss, which is all they will be able to see at first, but also into the bosom of God. He says that the interface that happens at that point, the only productive way to cope is to admit that the myth doesn't work, and to land yourself embracing the exile. The next chapter he talks about, aren't we all in exile? If the system doesn't work for gay people, and it doesn't seem to work for straight people, where do we find ourselves? Must you be forced down to your spiritual roots before you can tap them? No. The very special opportunity for spiritual deepening presented to gay people is offered to non-gay people in other ways. Those who seek spiritual guidance are on the same journey. Those who follow a guru tread the same path. The road to enlightenment is very broad. All you have to do is claim it. All it takes is seeing that the oppressors are oppressed, that the myth is a myth, and the ego is a figment of our imaginations. All you have to admit, and you can do it in the privacy of your own home, is that we are all in exile and that it is crazy to pretend we are not. It is always possible for everyone to go further and deeper, and to go deeper into the reality of what is inevitably leads us away from the self, away from the power-hungry ego, toward a more comprehensive map of the cosmos, one that ultimately makes an anthropocentric worldview possible, a worldview based on all people, all cultures, all varieties and styles of living. As we look more and more closely at the unfathomable complexity of the universe and begin to comprehend its enormity, we cannot but begin to feel inconsequential and powerless. In other words, the more we look out, the smaller we are. It's kind of like looking at the Earth when you can't, I mean, without telecommunications and without high-speed transportation, the Earth is huge. The more interconnected we get, the smaller the Earth gets. We go out into space, the Earth is this big, and it's blue, and it's spinning around. And the further out we get, the more we learn about the world around us and other people and the world outside of ourselves, the smaller and more insignificant we seem. We begin to notice that the discoveries of science, for instance, are nothing more than the word literally means, the uncovering of truths or wonders that were there all along. Discovery does not mean creation. It seems as though we're all pretty powerless right across the board. When we take a tour through all the nooks and crannies of the cosmic map, if we dare to look and experience, we can't help but be overwhelmed. The tension that this sense of not being in control creates in us is the common denominator of all of our exiles, gay or straight, male or female, black or white. The only sensible reason why anyone would choose to embrace rather than run from anxiety so profound and so pervasive is that ultimately it is easier. There are two steps in coming to believe this. The first one involves getting comfortable with anxiety. Anxiety is viewed as a bad thing by most people. It is, after all, one of those feelings of weakness which does not compute in the mythical program. Ironically, many patients come to therapy precisely to be cured of their anxiety. Even more ironic is that if the therapy is successful, what they truly end up with is learning how to tolerate it. At the same time, they learn that pain is not the end of the world, that they don't die of it, and that it is unavoidable. They come to know that the experience of pain isn't half as bad as the dread of it. In other words, the idea of pain gets cut down to size. The immediate experience of letting go into the angst of the human condition is relief. However grudging the letting go has been, it's followed by a feeling of, God, I'm glad that's over. What is over, of course, is not the anxiety, but all of the frenetic, futile, and energy-draining activity formerly engaged in to try to avoid the anxiety. As you give up trying to control this or ensure that or develop a surefire plan for thus and so, life gets immeasurably easier. You find there's energy to spare. To the extent that we aren't trying to control or manipulate or exploit people, we're free to behold them, to be fascinated by them, to love them in all of their wickedness and all of their virtue. To the extent that we aren't bent on raping the environment, we can be with it, revel in it, glory in it, and fear it. Insofar as we give up needing to be the center of the universe, we're free to stand in awe of it and be entranced by it, both its destructive aspect and its generative one. If we can just give up to the surging power of life, we can be empowered by it. What you're being invited to consider is that the spiritual depths down to which gay people are often thrust isn't such a bad place to be. In fact, it may be the only sane place to be. A blessing I'm sure gay people would be willing to share with any sanity-seeking heterosexuals. The next chapter he talks about the guides, teachers, and road signs, or as he calls it, witches and wizards. He talks about how there are some ways in which people who work with gay people and who try and help gay people through this experience and on their psychological, spiritual journeys have a few things that they really are better off doing and having. One, he says, is the ability to be empathic in the sense of understanding and relating to pain deeply. So that's a key. If you are able to be in touch with your pain and to experience it and to work through it and work with it, that will give you a much greater capacity to identify with the pain of people you're working with, whether they're gay or not. Another thing he regards as essential is a positive regard, an unconditional positive regard. It's okay for you to be who you are and to need what you need and to express what you need to express. Whether or not I, as someone who works with gay people, agree with you, I need to be able to feel and to affirm you, regardless of where you are on your journey. Another thing he says is very helpful is for someone to be spiritually traveled themselves, to know and accept and live the fact that the myth doesn't work, and it doesn't work for real, and it won't ever work. And finally, he says, something that's absolutely essential is for your technique in dealing with people needs to be absolutely rock solid. To be able to hold up the right mirror for the patient to see themselves, to hold up the right mirror at the right time, and to be able to do that in a succession of holding up ever larger mirrors. The self as the self sees, I mean, as for example, I as a person in therapy see myself, then to show me who I really am, to show me ways in which I'm acting out with the world or not dealing with the world realistically, then to show me pictures of my context within society, my context within the church, my context with God, my context in all of creation. To be able to do that, he says, is really essential. Only to the extent that therapists, whether or not they are Christian, can be Christ-like vehicles of God's love, can healing happen. Only to the degree that the therapist can see the reflection of Christ in all people, can the Christhood of any patient be called forth. Which lands us back in John Fortunato's living room. Love them anyway, I moaned, but how? You begin by just being who you are, God said, a loving, caring, whole person created in my image, whose special light of love happens to shine on men, as I intended for you. Is that all? I asked. God shook his head. No, you must also speak your pain and affirm the wholeness I've made you to be when they assail it. You must protest when you are treated as less than my child. Is there more? I asked. Yes, God said, and this is the hardest part of all. You must go out and teach them. Help them to know of their dependence on me for all that they really are, and of their helplessness without me. Teach them that their ways are not my ways, and that the world of their imagining is not the one I have made. Help them to see that all creation is one as I am one, and that all I create, I redeem. And assure them by word and work and example that my love is boundless and that I am with them always. You know they won't listen to me, I said with resignation. They'll despise me. They'll call me a heretic and laugh me to scorn. They'll persecute and torment me. They'll try to destroy me. You know they will, won't you? The radiant face saddened, and then God said softly, Oh yes, I know. How well I know. I heard his words, and something irrevocable changed in me. I went numb. Now I knew. Now I understood. And it was as though large chunks of who I had been began falling away, tumbling through time and space into eternity. I just let them all fall. No fear now, no resistance, no sense of loss. All that was dropping away was unnecessary now, extraneous. I began to feel light and warm. Energy began to surge through my whole being, enlivening me as though I were a rusty old turbine that had been charged up and was starting to hum. Then two strong motherly arms reached out and drew me close to the bosom of all that is, and I was just there, just being, enveloped in being, and we wept for joy.